I want to give a warm welcome to everyone who's come today. How many were here last evening? That's quite a few. It was a good lecture last night, and we're looking forward to another wonderful lecture today. Dr. DeRose, as we mentioned last night, is a lifestyle medicine specialist. He's boarded in internal medicine. He graduated from medical school 2 years before I did, so that makes him my senior and much wiser. He certainly knows a lot about lifestyle improvement. He's been involved in, I think, at least three live-in programs that people come and get inpatient treatment, and that's what he's doing now at Weimar, down near, not too far from Sacramento. So he has a lot to share with us. Our topic today, as you can see in your bulletin, Ancient Secrets, Modern Health. I think more in a lecture format. And again, I'll remind the children that I think you'll be involved here, so pay attention for that. And then this evening, after the meeting, which we also invite you to, the Methuselah Factor, there'll be some questions and answers, time given. Questions that are raised during today's presentation or this evening's. And also there'll be materials available for sale at that time, cookbooks and other resources that might be of benefit if you're interested in making some lifestyle changes. And also, last night, I think it was Lisa that asked me, said, well, can we sign up somewhere for future programs or get information? And we'll do that this evening as well. If you're not already on our mailing list or email list and you want to be notified if there's a cooking school or a gardening activity or something else that's going on health-related, we'll be happy to let you know. You can sign up then. So we're so glad that Dr. DeRose is here, and I'm going to read a short text from the New Testament, and that is found in the third epistle of John, verse 2. And John, of course, is the disciple who the scriptures say was loved by Jesus and loved Jesus so much. He wrote a lot about love. And part of loving other people is wanting them to be in good health, and this is what he was expressing to Gaius, who he was writing to, and all of the people there in that household. He says this, "Beloved, I pray that you may prosper in all things and be in health, just as your soul prospers." So certainly that's our prayer for each one of us today. We thank you, Dr. DeRose, for coming to help our souls and our bodies prosper. So share what you have with us. Thank you.
No doubt you've heard the names. Names like backwards, ignorant, foolish, superstitious. You see, all these names have been used by people in the 20th century to describe individuals and their beliefs from indigenous cultures. Can you relate to that? Whether it's Native American traditions or Asian traditions or indigenous African practices, there have often been these pejorative terms used to describe cultures of antiquity and their insights into health. But we're now in the 21st century. And actually, something that happened beginning late last century is more and more people started to say, perhaps we have been culturally arrogant. You see, some things have changed dramatically. And as a people, we're beginning to say maybe there is some great wisdom in these cultures of antiquity that we have neglected. Maybe there are things today that we can learn from ancient cultures that would make a difference in our health today. And I'd like to tell you, from having been involved in medical research for many years, I can tell you that there are growing interests in the scientific research community saying, look it, the solution is not always in drugs and high-tech surgeries and advanced procedures. No, this is not just fringe medicine anymore. I've actually been to Washington, D.C. area. I was some years ago in one of the meetings that was organized by the National Center for Complementary and Alternative Medicine. How many of you realize that we today in the United States have a whole center, a whole branch of the National Institutes of Health that is designed to look at what they call complementary and alternative therapies? Are you aware of that? This is a function of what's happening in our country and what's happening in research circles. And much of what is happening in the research community in complementary and alternative therapies is looking at indigenous practices throughout the world. And I know I've presented lectures at national meetings, international meetings, where we talk about these very issues. In fact, I'm the member of a group that's part of the largest group of preventive medicine and public health professionals in the world. It's called the American Public Health Association. And I'm actually a member of a smaller group in APHA that is devoted to looking at complementary and alternative therapies. And every year, literally 10, 15, 20,000 people meet different locations throughout America and discuss the cutting-edge therapies in alternative and complementary therapies. And so I'd like to suggest to you that the very fact you're here today at least suggests you must have some passing interest in these things. I know some of you regularly come to this church for a worship service. I will tell you today this is going to be a different program than you're probably used to, but perhaps not as different as you might think. Because I have to share with you a caveat. You see, historically, in some Christian circles, this presentation that we're going to have today would actually not have been welcome. You see, as I meet with Christians throughout the world, and I've been a consultant, and in fact I still am, for a large non-denominational Christian health group. They have over 50,000 members. And so I work with people of all different Christian faith backgrounds, as well as people from all different faith traditions. And I've been acutely aware of something in the Christian world. And that is, many Christians actually have not carefully studied the Bible. Isn't that hard to believe? They say that they believe the Bible, they accept the Bible as God's Word, and because they've not studied the Bible, they often have false ideas of who the God of the Bible is and what He's like. And so I hear my non-Christian friends often describing Christians as intolerant. Some of you here today may not feel you're from a Christian faith tradition. And you say, yeah, I mean, those Christians are so intolerant. You say they're arrogant oftentimes. They act like they have all the answers and no one else knows anything. They're elitists. You know, they kind of stand back. You know, we're better. And they're xenophobic. You know what xenophobic means? It's afraid of anything foreign. See, you know, if you're a Christian, you come here and you can talk with us, but, you know, you're from some other background. No, you stay away. Now, I'd like to tell you that the very fact I'm here indicates that there are people in this community who identify themselves as Christians and Seventh-day Adventists, because I'm speaking in a Seventh-day Adventist church, who are not like this. They believe that the God of the Bible is an open God who loves everyone, who accepts people where they're at, who takes them right where they're at and helps them. They believe that God is not exclusive, that He's seeking to reach all people. And in fact, like the scripture that was read by Dr. Guthrie, He's not just a God who's interested in your spiritual life. Did you hear what he read from that little book, 3 John? God is interested in you prospering and being in health. There's a wonderful picture. And yet many Christians miss this. They say, if you don't think exactly the way I do, then we really don't want to hear from you. You're not really welcome here in our congregation. That's not what I have heard here in Mount Shasta. But I'm just letting you know. So today as we begin, I want to give you that background because there's some amazing insights into the truth about who God is in the Bible that give us some insight into why we would want to look at indigenous practices throughout the world. Why we would in a church have a presentation on ancient secrets and how it relates to modern health. Look with me at Romans chapter 1. I have it projected here on the screen from today's English version. The Apostle Paul, a Hebrew scholar, by the way, who became a Christian, is writing these words. He says, "Ever since God created the world, his invisible qualities, both his eternal power and his divine nature, have been clearly seen. They are perceived in the things that God has made." What is Paul saying here? He's saying that creation, the things around us, give us an insight into who God is. Now, who has access to seeing what's around us? Yeah, everybody. But it's very interesting. I've noticed that some of the people that have the greatest insight into the things around us are the people that are not surrounded by all the things that we think are so important in the 21st century. You know, they don't have the, you know, big screen TV and the iPods and, you know, the cars. Now, don't misunderstand me. I'm not saying any of those things in and of themselves are necessarily wrong. But the people that live very close to nature often have insights into health and into, if you will, the Creator, that many people, even who may be worshiping in a church or a synagogue or some other faith community, do not have. Does that make some sense? Can you see that that might be true? Here's another Bible text. We could look at many today. I'm just showing you two to let you know that although some Christians historically haven't understood this, and this presentation might not be welcome in some churches, I want to let you know, whether you're a regular churchgoer or you're just here because you're interested in the health presentation, this message is a message that speaks to everyone. And it's right in the Hebrew Scriptures, the Old Testament, and the New Testament as well. Look at this scripture, Psalm 19. It says, "The heavens declare the glory of God, and the sky above proclaims his handiwork." Now, for some years, I lived in the New York City area. And you know, there's so much light in the New York City area that you really can't see the heavens above all that well. But there were people that we knew there in New York City. If you talked with them about going out into nature, out into the country, they would be afraid. In fact, we lived about an hour outside Manhattan, and we'd have people come up. We were running a health center there. And once a woman came into our center, she was just trembling with fear. She had seen a ferocious wild animal while on one of our trails. One of these animals that can kill people. It's called a, maybe you have them here, I don't know. It's called a deer. No, really, I'm serious. This is true. She had never seen a deer, and it was just so frightening to her to see this large wild animal. I have heard that deer have attacked people. Very unusual. There's many where we live, like you two, and I've never been accosted by a deer. But you see, what I'm trying to help you see is often we think that we've arrived. You know, we're on the penthouse on Park Avenue, and we have the good things in life, and we're detached from some of these things that people throughout every faith and cultural tradition have said often have the insights that we need. Whether it's the Bible saying that nature reveals the Creator, or whether it's Chinese wisdom, or African wisdom, or Native American wisdom that says, in creation, in nature around us, there are answers that we need about our health. So my premise today, as we look at some of these fascinating insights, is that the Bible itself, if you're from a Christian or a Jewish faith tradition, and you revere the Old and New Testament scriptures or one or the other, the Bible itself tells us that nature is filled with revelations about God. And that cultures that have lived closest to nature will therefore have been most likely to discern truth about God through his works. And finally, I believe this is true of indigenous people throughout the world. Now, some of you might say, well, this sounds like it might be okay. Let me put it this way for you. I've projected this on the screen. My belief, as both a physician and kind of an amateur anthropologist, I've traveled a fair amount. I work with a lot of different cultures. In fact, as some of you may know, I host a weekly radio show. It's a syndicated show. It's actually called American Indian Living. It's designed to especially reach Native Americans. I lived for many years in Oklahoma, which has the largest concentration, percentage-wise, of Native Americans. So I do a lot of cross-cultural work, so I'm very interested in this. But a better understanding of God and His ways is to our benefit, regardless of our culture, and regardless of how you refer to God. Are you with me here? So, one more biblical text for you that just gives you a further insight into what kind of a God the Bible reveals, even if Christians and Jews have not always done justice to the God they profess to worship. Look here from Isaiah chapter 48, an Old Testament passage. Thus says the Lord, your Redeemer. So how is God revealing Himself in this scripture? As your Redeemer. What does a Redeemer do? Saves you, rescues you when you have problems. He reveals Himself as the Redeemer, but He's also the Holy One of Israel. He says, I am the Lord your God. I do what? I teach you to profit. I lead you in the way you should go. So I believe today that we are going to come in touch with the God of the universe as we study together today, but it will be from a very different perspective. One more caveat, and I have to tell you this because this is one of the most common mistakes I find as I deal with cross-cultural perspectives. And here it is. Despite the wisdom of ancient cultures when it comes to specific insights into health in the context of what we'll be looking at today, this does not necessarily validate what we would call their cosmologies. A cosmology is a worldview. You see, and every people try to grapple with what's around them, and they try to put it into a worldview. What is the prevailing cosmology in America today? What is the prevailing sense of how we got here? You know, whether you're a Christian or an atheist or an agnostic, as I once was, what would be the prevailing cosmology? Yes, evolution, the Big Bang, that we're here by chance, that there was this explosion billions of years ago, and then all the planets were created and things evolved. This is the prevailing cosmology. Now you say some people believe that, you say other people reject it. And in ancient cultures, no ancient culture had that for a cosmology. You know, just to let you know. None of them believed in a Big Bang billions of years ago and things just happening by themselves. They all had different cosmologies, and I want to tell you, they're all just about mutually exclusive. They all contradict one another. So what I'm trying to help you see today, as we look at these different cultures, I've chosen three cultures that we're going to focus on today. It's not because they're better than others, and I'll actually give you some examples from a fourth culture as well. But I've chosen those examples not to say that their cosmology, their way of putting everything together, is necessarily validated because they contradict themselves. But to say that there's true wisdom that we can find in each of these cultures, even if we say we don't agree to the way they've synthesized it all. Are you with me? So, let me give you a few insights to help you appreciate that from the ancient healing technique of Umaguchi. How many of you have heard of Umaguchi? Okay, let's say I never heard of it either. And so, I'm really sick. This is a hypothetical situation. And I've been having terrible pain, terrible joint discomfort. I'm fatigued. And I'm seeing the conventional physicians. One of them says, well, it's obvious what you have, you have fibromyalgia. And they start giving me all these medicines, and I start taking these drugs and going to the physical therapist, and I'm feeling worse and worse. Is this not helping me? Someone says, listen, I see a great rheumatologist. You have obviously got some arthritis. So I go to see the rheumatologist. And the rheumatologist evaluates me and does blood tests and says, you have seronegative rheumatoid arthritis. I say, what is that? Seronegative? Well, I mean, I know what it is. I'm a physician, but let's say I'm not a physician even. And he says, well, it means the blood tests don't show that you have rheumatoid arthritis, but in my clinical experience, that's what you have. And we've got these great new drugs, these powerful drugs that suppress your immune system that we want to give you. Maybe you should don't say it in those words. And so I start taking them, you know? And I end up in the intensive care unit with a lung infection. Maybe I was visiting down some friends in Bakersfield, and I got valley fever, coccidiomycosis. And I feel even worse. And so I've been going to doctor after doctor, and finally, you know, I'm just laying in bed. I can't work anymore. I keep hearing these people saying, telling about this fellow here in Mount Shasta area that practices Umaguchi. And let's say his name is Xerxes. Okay, is there a guy named Xerxes here who practices Umaguchi? Well, you don't even know what Umaguchi is, so obviously probably no one here like that. This is a hypothetical situation. So I say, look, and I'm desperate. I mean, it sounds like craziness, but I'm going to go see this Xerxes. Everybody who goes to him seems to get better. So I go and I see Xerxes. And he is, you know, a very quiet fellow. And he looks at me and he says, well, you know, listens to my story. And then he does an exam. Now, I've been to doctors before. You know, they usually start with your head and neck. I mean, depending on what kind of doctor it is. But this Dr. Xerxes is kind of strange. He has me take my socks off first. And he takes out a voltmeter, and he puts one probe on one big toe and another probe on the other. And he's looking at the voltage, he's writing it down. Some of you say, oh, this is really wise. He's, you know, measuring energy fields in the body. I think it's kind of weird myself because, you know, I never saw that before. But, I mean, everyone's getting good results. Next, he says, we're going to do another test. And he pulls my lower eyelid down, and he takes out a piece of litmus paper. You know what litmus paper is? It's used to measure pH, the acidity of fluids. And he measures the pH of the fluid around my eyes, and he writes that down. He says, now these are some higher tech things that Umaguchi has incorporated. But traditionally, we didn't do this. We're going to do some of the traditional diagnostic. Now, I need to have you come outside. I said, come outside. It's an interesting place to do an exam. He says, we have to see how your body form bends your shadow from the sun. Bends my shadow. Well, I'm out there and he's, you know, looking, he's measuring my shadow. I mean, I think this is really pretty strange, but he measures my shadow. And then he says, now we have to do something very special. We have to taste your secretions. And he starts licking me on my hand and on my face. I mean, this is really weird, okay? I mean, fortunately, just the hand and face, that's all. But I mean, he says, I've got the diagnosis. You're about to die of liver cancer. You also have, you're nearing renal failure. Your kidneys are about to shut down. I say, this is crazy. I mean, no, none of the other... He said, this is what you got to do. He says, you've got to stop eating all that meat you've been eating. That's a hypothetical situation. I'm a vegetarian at this point in my life, even though I used to eat a lot of meat. So I said, but I'm only eating meat 3 times a day. He says, no, you've got to cut all the meat out. Okay? And he says, you've got to start exercising. Exercise? I mean, I'm sick. I mean, I never liked to exercise to begin with. He says, you got to start walking. Even if you can only do a few feet, get outside and start walking. He says, you got to get out in the sunshine. I said, sunshine? I've been inside all the time. I'm sick. The doctor said, you know, I shouldn't get chilled. No, you got to get out in the sunshine. And you got to start drinking lots of water. Water? I mean, listen. I mean, one of the few things I can enjoy in life is, you know, my Coca-Cola. No, you got to drink water. And so I think this is crazy. But, you know, what have I got to lose? So I start drinking more water, start to go outside in the sunshine a little bit, start exercising, start eating lots of fruits and vegetables. And you know what? I start getting better. And I get better and better. And I'm healed. Wasn't Umaguchi amazing? Now just wait a minute. If we could objectively pull back the curtain on that story, let's say there was really no liver cancer and no renal failure. And we could tell 100%. We had a way to evaluate it. Not even microscopic. No liver cancer. No problems with the kidneys. Well, how could I have gotten better if Umaguchi was not a true therapy? Was not a true healing system? What do you think? Is it possible? Do any of you have an answer? How could it be? Okay, this woman here speaks up very softly. And she says, it's because they told you to do a lot of things that were good for you. You see? Doesn't matter whether the healing approach was true or not. Do you see the point in the story? Many healing systems have benefited people, even though some of their philosophical foundations were not necessarily based on truth at all. So we're not going to go there today. We're not going to say that something is bad, has no value, just because it's not based on a scientific foundation. There may be true principles that are woven into a system that we might say from an objective view is false. Now, does that bother you? Can we actually learn something even from a system that we may say objectively is not true? Possible? Here's the key points I want you to see. And by the way, this is background, because we've got some very important things happening this morning, including a children's story. We'll come up in just a few moments here. But the key points I'm trying to give you, foundational points, before we look at these cultures. One is, just because a cosmological perspective or cosmology or philosophy has been invalidated, you say there's nothing to it, it doesn't mean that there's no wisdom contained in the practices of that philosophy. And finally, in fact, to the contrary, there may be many true healing practices, even from a Western perspective, when we would label the healing system as false. I give you this background, and you might say, well, boy, this, I thought you were, this was going to be really interesting. You show all these slides and all, you're just talking all this head stuff. I'm trying to help you see this to begin with, because I know a lot of times people say, well, I'm very worried. This guy's talking about all these different cultures, and how can they all be true? They all believe different things. I'm just trying to help you see. In the research community, this is what's happening today. They're saying, let's look at these different traditional practices. It's not saying that they believe the whole system of healing. It's saying these systems that have been in existence for centuries, isn't it likely that just by observation, these people who have lived close to nature, and you might say from a Christian perspective, have lived close to the God of nature, that they would have some true healing insights? And so that's what we want to try to learn from today. Let me just give you an example of this. There are many wonderful people from the Indian subcontinent. And many of you realize that one of the ancient healing systems, Ayurveda, comes from India, dating back over 3,000 years, nearly 4,000 years. And so as we look at an example from Ayurveda, we're going to look in more detail at some other cultures, but I just want to help you see how this could be illustrated with a given healing system. This is actually some text of an ancient Indian Veda written in Sanskrit. I can't read it, but those who've translated tell us that the roots of the word Ayurveda come from Ayus, which means life, and Veda, which means knowledge. So it's a system that purports to have knowledge about life. It's a cosmological system as well as a healing system. It's a philosophical system. And so, here's the question. Do educated Indians today accept the cosmological basis of Ayurveda? And I would tell you that many of them don't. I've studied under medical doctors who are from India, worked under a gastroenterologist and a cardiologist who were from India, and they didn't believe in the philosophical bases of Ayurveda. But they believed, many of them, in some of the ancient wisdom that is contained in Ayurvedic practices. So they didn't believe, for example, that everything is composed of five elements. Like many ancient cultures, some of you know the Greek view was very similar. In Ayurveda, there's these five elements, that everything is composed of these five elements: air, earth, water, space, and fire. And most modern Indian scientists do not believe that, at least in my experience. You might say it's a very selective experience. But they would say, no, this is not a true cosmology. These dashas that are spoken about in Ayurvedic practice, about an imbalance that has similarities with the yin and yang of other Asian cultures, but most scientifically trained Indians do not embrace this philosophical construct. They say, no, Ayurveda, as a way of understanding how we got here in life, is not accurate. But they would say there is great wisdom, though, in some of these Ayurvedic practices. How many of you have ever heard the statement, 2 hours of sleep before midnight is worth four after? Have any of you ever heard that? Do you actually know where that is purported to have first been found? It's in Ayurvedic wisdom. So does that make it untrue? Or is it possibly a true insight of people over many centuries that had insight into true health practices? Are you aware that today, modern science has shown us that if you get to bed early, you have higher levels of growth hormone and melatonin, two of the healing restorative compounds in the body? So should I throw out this Ayurvedic insight, or should I stop and say, look at this, people... These native Indians for centuries have looked at health and health practices in light of nature, and they feel that this is an important principle. Would it be well for me to pay some attention to it? Do you see what I'm asking? How about healing herbs? You know, there are many, many healing herbs that are mentioned in Ayurvedic writings. A couple of them that I'm especially interested in. One is turmeric. How many of you have used turmeric? Yes, it's that yellow spice used in curries and various dishes. How many of you are aware that turmeric has very potent anti-inflammatory properties? Are you aware of that? And so often when I'm giving someone a natural prescription for anti-inflammatories, I will use some of this Ayurvedic wisdom, and I'll prescribe turmeric in addition perhaps to omega-3 fats, like found in flaxseed oil, that have anti-inflammatory properties. Another East Indian herb that is written about in Ayurvedic wisdom is something called Gymnema sylvestre. How many of you have heard of Gymnema? Any of you? Okay, I see a few of you. Gymnema is very interesting. It has anti-diabetic properties. I was just seeing a patient a few days ago at Weimar. I work at the Lifestyle Center there at Weimar. We have people come and they live with us for several weeks at a time. We help people with diabetes get off their medications, and people with heart disease thrive without using lots of drugs, high blood pressure, obesity, various chronic diseases they come with, and we try to help them using these natural principles. This gentleman had come using something, I think it was in the range of 100, 150 units of insulin a day, and he's currently using maybe 20. But we were trying to get him off the insulin, and I was talking with him about different options. I said there's natural options as well as drug options. And he seemed interested in some of these natural remedies. One of them was Gymnema sylvestre, so he began to take that. Gymnema not only has anti-diabetic properties, actual medical research has shown that Gymnema has a compound that suppresses appetite. So if you're wanting to eat less, you're trying to lose weight, Gymnema can help with weight reduction as well as improving blood sugar control. Where is that from? That wisdom came from Ayurvedic wisdom. So does that mean I believe in the three dashas and the five principles of life if I learn something from Ayurvedic insights? Is that what it means? What do you think? No, you don't have to believe in the whole system. You may feel, well, the system doesn't fit with what I know about nature and about science. But there's many true insights in this practice. How about cutting-edge insights about meal timing? Are you aware that many cultures, like East Indian cultures, spoke about the dangers of eating between meals? You know, it's amazing to me, and maybe we'll talk about this in our question and answer session tonight, that many people today in America have this idea that if you graze throughout the day, this is the healthiest lifestyle. But this is contrary to most indigenous insights. And by the way, it's actually contrary to what I told you last night about the Alameda County Health Study. Some of you were here last night. Remember I told you about Dr. Breslow and his research? In the Alameda County Health Study, they found one predictor of early mortality, dying early, was eating between meals more frequently. Okay, I think it's time for a children's story. Where do you kids like to come up for a story? I heard this is a high point in the morning. Some of the kids, you know, they were tempted to fall asleep here. Okay. So we've got some of them coming up front here. You sit right up here. Is that how it works?
Around this area.
Oh, you're going to sit there, not up front, huh? Because you're a big guy, huh? So the littler ones sit over here. Okay. Okay. Okay, we got a number coming up here for the children's story. Okay, good to see you looking out for one another. Okay, we're going to talk about something that's potentially a very dangerous. Are you children very easily frightened? Good, okay, I think we can tell you this story then. And if any of the parents get upset with me or grandparents, they probably just won't invite me back. Okay, this is a true story, and it happened to a fellow that we'll call Jim. That's not his real name, because Jim didn't give me permission to tell his story, even though I know it's true. So Jim lived in a part of the country far from here, a place near where my mother-in-law lived for many years, and she's actually here today. And if you were to meet Edna, where is she? She's right there. You see her? It's my mother-in-law. And if you asked her where she lived, what do you think she'd tell you? You can always try it. Anyone you want to try? Ask her where she has lived for many years before she moved to California. No one wants to ask, huh? Maybe I'll ask her. Mama, where did you live before you came here to California?
Tennessee.
Did you hear what she said? Tennessee. Have you ever heard of Tennessee? It's way far away. And in Tennessee, in North Carolina, there's some mountains called the Great Smoky Mountains. And Jim used to love to go to the Great Smoky Mountains. He was a grown man, but he loved to go up there and see a certain animal. What kind of animal do you think he liked to see in the Great Smoky Mountains? Mountain lion? That was a good guess, but that's not what he liked to look for.
Deer?
That was an excellent guess, but that's not what he liked to look for. It was actually an animal that really is kind of dangerous. A bear, you're exactly right. He liked to see the black bear. Now, in the old days, this is an old story. You know, nowadays, if you go to any place where there's bears, they don't just have garbage cans you can throw the garbage in. Do you know that? They have these special bear-proof garbage cans that you see, like they have some lever you got to push, you got to open it and get in, so the bears can't get the garbage. But in the old days, when this story took place about Jim, they had the old garbage cans just all open. And there were big signs all in the park. Great Smoky Mountains National Park, do not feed the bears. Well, Jim just loved to see the bears eat. He wanted to feed the bears, but he didn't want to disobey the signs. So he did something that probably wasn't really right. He said, well, it doesn't say you can't throw food in the garbage, so I'll just throw, if I see a bear around, I'll throw all this food in the garbage, and the bear will eat it out of the garbage, and I'll watch him eating. So that's what he would do. He'd have all this food with him when he wanted to see bears. He'd go throw all, when he saw a bear around, he'd throw all this food in the garbage, and he'd watch the bear eat the garbage. Well, it wasn't really garbage, it was the food he put in there. Do you see how that works? So, Jim decided one day he was going to drive up in the Smoky Mountains with lots of food. He brought all this food with him in his car, and he and his wife and some friends went up there, and they're going to go see the bears, the black bears. And so he goes up, and they have these little parks, little picnic areas along the road there, and so he pulled on. Just as he pulled in, when he sees the bear running off into the woods, they said, oh, We know where the bear's going. He's going to go to the next picnic area down the road. So they drive in their car and they get there, and Jim jumps out with his food. And he's carrying this big bag of food and he's looking around for the bear. Now Jim notices there's another family. They just got out of their car. And they had one of those old kind of station wagons. It's kind of like a pickup. And you could open the back of the station wagon, you could put your food there, and you could have a little picnic right in the back of your car. So that's what they were doing. They had just started their picnic, and they had their chicken and their pie and whatever they were eating, all spread out there getting ready for a beautiful meal. Meanwhile, Jim's out there with his bag looking around for the bear, and his wife is in the car. What do you think his wife's looking for? The bear. Because she wants Jim to know if the bear's coming. He doesn't want the bear to come while he's got the food in his bag. So his wife's looking out, and Jim's looking out that way. His wife's looking over there. Quick! The bear! Throw the food in the garbage! And Jim heard his wife, and before he could get to the garbage, he noticed those people with the station wagon. They just grabbed all their food off the back of the station wagon, and they threw it all in the garbage! You see, they heard someone cry out, "Bear's coming! Throw all your food in the garbage!" And they just did that. They threw it all into the garbage can. And then Jim went by and he threw his food in there. And the people in the station wagon, they closed their station wagon. They drove off. They were all afraid. But what did Jim and his family do? Jim, his wife, and his friends, they just sat there and watched. And that bear was eating all Jim's food and all the chicken and all the other things that the people had put in there. Now, that may not have been the best meal for the bear. But there's a real lesson in that story, isn't there? Did Jim get good advice from his wife? Did his wife help him? Yeah, helped him do what he wanted to do. But you know what? Did you notice those other people? Did they get good advice? Well, they probably didn't have to throw all their food away into the garbage can. It was a good thing they drove off, or at least they closed up their food. That would have been a problem. But here's the lesson. We have to be very careful who we're listening to. You see? Even if it looks like good things happen when we do what other people tell us, if we're not listening to a voice of truth, we can get into trouble. Do you know what I've learned in my life is a voice of truth to me? Is the Bible. That's what I've learned. I didn't always know that when I was little, but that's what I've learned. And you can read the Bible, and you can believe that, and you can trust it. Okay, thank you for being such good listeners. You go back to your seats. Well, hopefully you connected a little bit with that children's story too, as we're speaking about wisdom of the ancients and the different voices that are telling us different solutions today. Now, I was told that your service this morning was changed a little bit so that it wouldn't go to 1 o'clock. So I know that I have to stop by 10 to 1. That was the implicit message. But since you've already been sitting here for quite a while, we're going to stop well before then. But we will go to about 12:40. If that's too late for some of you, just when I turn my back, you can slip out and I won't be offended at all. Are you recording the presentation as well? You guys recording it back there? Okay, they're recording it. So if any of you, you know, have diabetes and you get hypoglycemic at 12 o'clock because you haven't yet learned some of those secrets that can get you off of insulin, we'll understand. But you'll definitely, you know, want to get the recording. And come tonight because we can answer your questions about how you can do that. So no question and answer session today, but I just want to give you some framework because actually all I've given you to this point is background. It's just background. So if you didn't like the background, you say right in your comments, you'll have a chance to write some comments later, you say, tell that crazy doctor, nobody cares about cosmology and xenophobia, and just give us the stories about the cultures, okay? So, and you see, part of the problem with me, I'll just be honest with you, not only am I a physician, not only am I a health educator, I have a master's in public health with an emphasis in health promotion and health education, but I'm also a college teacher. I've been doing that for about 4 years. And you know, once you get into the academic environment, you feel you got to explain things to everybody. And sometimes you explain so much that they say, well, that's why I never went to college, because all they do is put you to sleep. Okay, so now we do the health education stuff. These three cultures that I want to look with you at today. Three cultures of antiquity I've chosen because they provide profound insights into health from three very different perspectives. The first ancient culture actually has remarkable lifestyle similarities to how we live today. I think you're going to find it fascinating when we look at this. One of the most amazing cultures of antiquity, the insights that we have. The second culture provides a stark contrast, what might have been even here throughout the last several centuries. Some amazing insights from a second culture, what might have been if we hadn't gone on the lifestyle path we've followed as a nation. And then the third culture demonstrates amazing insights into how we can get the best from both ancient and modern wisdom. So if you have to leave early, the third one is the most important. It'd be better to leave, slip out, and then come back than miss the end of this presentation, okay? And if you leave early because you're disappointed, the best part's at the end. I'm just telling you. So if you're tired and you feel you need some rest, sleep now. Tell the person next to you to wake you up when it comes to the third part of the presentation. Are we all on the same wavelength? Okay, so let's look at the first one. We're going to go to one of antiquity's great cultures. And immediately when I show you this image, you know we're speaking about Egypt. The continent of Africa, the place Egypt, that great culture of antiquity. And you know, when it comes to knowing about diseases in any culture, Egypt is probably without a parallel. And we know so much about the diseases of Egypt because of the remarkable record we have in the mummies. Whether you agree with Egyptian cosmology or not, they had profound insights into how to preserve bodies after they died. It's amazing what we can learn from the mummies. For some of you, you may not realize why the Egyptians did mummify. It actually had to do with their belief about what happened when a person died. And we know about this from various Egyptian records. They believed that the physical body, without going into great detail, was very important for it to be preserved in order for the person to live eternally. And that's why they mummified. So mummification was very important. Why the name mummy? It's a very interesting bit of history about the word mummy. It actually comes from an Arabic term. Arabic travelers found some of these early mummies coated with a black material, and they applied a name to it. Mumia, that refers to bitumen or a dark tarry substance. So that's where the word mummy actually comes from. So how was it done? How was mummification actually performed? Well, there's actually no technical description on record from the Egyptians of how it was actually done. We have some insight from wall carvings in some of the tombs and wall illustrations, but we really do not have a precise description from the Egyptians themselves. However, Herodotus, many of you know him, he was called the father of history, the great Greek historian who lived around 450 BC. Herodotus wrote about the different types of approaches that were used in mummification. Three methods. There was one used for the wealthy, another for the not quite so rich, and then one for the common people. We're going to look today at how they mummified the wealthy individuals because these bodies were the very best preserved. So here's how the rich were mummified. Just a quick outline, then I'll show you some pictures to give you a feel for how it was done. They would first make incisions in the body. They'd remove most all the vital organs because these things would decay quickly. They then treated the body with spices and frankincense. They dried out the body for some 70 days in a salt called natron, and then they filled the body with linen, sawdust, and other things. They applied those expensive wrappings, a mask, put it in a coffin, and did the final touches. So if you were to look at actually what happened, this is a reconstruction of actually the mummification process from the Field Museum in Chicago. And here is an illustration of them cutting into the corpse, taking out the organs. These are some of the tools that have been found by archaeologists that were used to remove organs like the brain. This is an actual scan of a mummy. You can see it packed with various substances there, and you could see the incision in the abdomen. This is a scanning video. If you actually look inside the mummy after the packing has been removed, you see that all the vital organs have been removed except the remnants of the heart, which is right here. They would not remove the heart. And these various organs would be put into these canopic jars. So they take the organs out, like I said. Then they would dry the body out for 70 days in this natron salt. For some of you who are very interested in mummification, you might want the recipe here. It's sodium bicarbonate, calcium carbonate, sodium chloride, and sodium sulfate. We don't recommend that you mummify anyone, but this is what they did. They actually had this naturally occurring natron that was very effective in drawing water out of the corpse. Next, they would pack the body with linen and sawdust after they had dried it out. Then they would wrap the body. And after the body was all wrapped, they would put the finishing touches on, a mask, and then put it in a coffin. So well preserved are these bodies that we can actually do DNA studies of the mummies. Actually, there's genetic material that you can get from the mummies. It's amazing what we know today. Many researchers have looked at mummies. Dr. Rosalie David at Manchester University in England was one of the early mummy researchers. Dr. Angelique Courthals, a very famous researcher doing her work currently. Many of the illustrations I have are actually from Dr. Courthals. And we know a lot about many ancient rulers. Ramesses II, known as Ramesses the Great. How many of you have heard of Ramesses the Great? Very famous Egyptian pharaoh. This is actually believed to be his body right here. And they've actually looked at his body, his mummified body, and they found his arteries look like this. They're basically almost totally blocked off in some cases. He had severe atherosclerosis. Many books have been written about the mummies. This is one of them, Egyptian Medicine by Carol Reeves. This is showing some x-rays that show calcified arteries of atherosclerosis. So why was heart disease so common in Egypt? Well, they had a lifestyle that was known to promote heart disease. They had lots of leisure. This is the wealthy, remember? Lots of leisure and lack of exercise. They ate lots of animal products. Listen to this. This is an actual description by an anthropologist. The Egyptian noble shaved. Sound familiar, anyone? They bathed frequently. Is this bad? No. And sometimes put on a ceremonial wig. Some have suggested I should do that. He wore a white linen shirt and sandals, and at times threw a light shawl over his shoulders with jeweled collar, ear studs. Interesting, isn't it? Fly whisks. He and his wife expressed sophisticated elegance. Could this easily pass for modern day America? What do you think? Pretty amazing. What would they do? They wanted to have a cool home, light and airiness. They sat on chairs and dined at a table. They could take their leisure in the arbor of a garden. They could listen to a blind harper chant a love song or an old heroic tale. So they didn't have DVDs and CDs or whatever. They didn't have their iPods, but they could enjoy fine music because they had the live musicians there. They had lots of leisure. Listen to this, entertainment. Wearing their finest regalia and cones of sweet-smelling ointment on their head. That was their way of having perfume. They would attend gala dinner parties. Sounds like another culture I'm familiar with. And there would be servants that would serve them. They had air conditioning back then. It's true, it was human air conditioning. Servants with fans, but they had their air conditioning. And they were plied with food and drink to the full. Have you ever been anywhere where you were plied with food and drink to the full? I think you can relate to this. The high point in the entertainment came with the acrobatic dancers, scantily clad girls specializing in the high kick. I mean, Las Vegas, someone said. I mean, it sounds like modern-day American living. I mean, with a little, you know, some cultural variation there. They enjoyed fine music. They had quality musical instruments. So it's amazing, isn't it? You look at their diet, and you get all kinds of insights, both from the archaeology and from the art. You can see the kind of things that they were eating. They were eating lots of animal products. whether it was roast duck or other foods. Look at this here. While the food of the common people was barely adequate at best, those who were best preserved as mummies, the wealthy people, what did they have? They had meat, waterfowls, vegetables, fruit, and wine, part of their diet, as was the ubiquitous bread in one of its many guises. You can see here partridge, quail, pigeon, poultry, game, all kinds of things the Egyptians were eating. Now, there were other heart disease risk factors that the mummies reveal. One of the most famous rulers of Egypt was a woman, and her name is Hatshepsut. Around Hatshepsut are many other pharaohs, and their names all end in Mose. You see that? Many Bible historians believe that Hatshepsut was the adopted mother or adoptive mother of Moses, gave him a name like the other pharaohs of the day. Although it's true it means Moses means drawn up, it also can refer to these names that was common in the Egyptian rulers of that day. So Hatshepsut, very fascinating woman pharaoh. Many exhibits and museums have been featuring Hatshepsut. She actually ruled Egypt not as queen, but as king. She was King Hatshepsut. She wore that royal headpiece with the cobra on it. You see there the remnants of it. And also, do you notice, this is Hatshepsut. What else does she have? She has the ceremonial beard. She was ruling as pharaoh. Very interesting. Well, just a couple of years ago, headlines came out that they believed that they had identified the mummy of Hatshepsut. Here she is. It says, mummy is Egypt's most powerful female pharaoh. That's what the news wires carried. And there she is, beautiful Hatshepsut. Maybe she was beautiful once. But look at how she was described in that report. The long-overlooked mummy of an obese woman who likely suffered from diabetes and liver cancer, has been identified as Queen Hatshepsut, ancient Egypt's most powerful female pharaoh, Egyptian archaeologists said Wednesday. Did you catch this? What problems did she have? Obesity, diabetes, and liver cancer. Does this sound familiar? Are these common diseases in America today? Are you seeing some striking similarities between the Egyptians and the diseases that we face today in America? Obesity was so common in Egypt that we actually have artistic renditions of individuals, not even necessarily the leaders, but here's someone ministering in the royal court. And can you see this gentleman? If you only have two rolls of fat, you're trim compared to this individual playing the harp. A grossly obese harpist is how he's been described in that illustration. Why did the Egyptians have such problems with obesity? Well, they had lots of leisure and they had lots of animal products. These are things we know in research today are connected with obesity. They also enjoyed their desserts. Do you know that large amount of dessert consumption has a correlation with overweight? Are you aware of that? And they consume large amounts of caloric beverages. Do any of you have any idea what their favorite beverage was? We'll get to that in a minute, but here's some illustrations of their sweet desserts. What was their preferred beverage in Egypt? Any of you know? Wine? Any other guesses? Beer. Listen to some of these Egyptian sources. This is an inscription over 4,000 years old. The mouth of a perfectly contented man is filled with what? Beer. Now, here's one for you parents that have children who go to school. How many of you have school children here? Anyone? Any kids that go to school? Okay, I see a number of them. Okay, listen. Is this what happens when you come home? You were sent by your mother to school, and when you were ready to be taught writing, that's when you went, and she waited for you daily at home with what? Bread and beer. This was a staple beverage in Egypt. Are you aware that one of the reasons we have an obesity epidemic in America is because of the consumption of alcoholic beverages? Alcoholic beverages, alcohol itself, is one of the most concentrated nutritional foods that we have. You look at some segments of our population, the largest percentage of calories that are being consumed is in the form of alcohol, especially young men. Alcoholic beverages, huge amount of calories, nearly twice as many calories in alcohol as there are in pure sugar. Are you aware of that? 7 calories per gram in alcohol, 4 calories per gram in sugar. Amazing, isn't it? And you wonder why. Furthermore, if you have just a little bit of alcohol, it lowers your resolve to be careful with your eating habits. I used to work in the restaurant industry before I knew much about health principles or even the God of health principles. And it's very important in the restaurant industry to make sure you offer your guests, your patrons, alcoholic beverages before they eat. Why do you think that's important? Not only do they make a lot of profit on the alcohol, if they drink a little bit, they're more likely to eat more, you see? They're more likely to say, well, you know, this is a special occasion. We could have the 2 servings of dessert. You know, it's a special. See? Why not have a third? You know, we only tried the ice cream and the cake, and they have the special brownies, the house special today. Do you see how that works? Very interesting, isn't it? So there is this connection between alcoholic beverages and obesity as well as cancer. Even though many people are touting alcoholic beverages for their health benefits, the health benefits of alcoholic beverages, you may have questions about this that we can talk about tonight, but the health benefits come because all alcoholic beverages are made from plant products. So there are many healthy things in plants, and if you ferment the plants, some of those healthy ingredients are still there. But the very best evidence we have today from objective researchers is you can get all the benefits from plants by eating lots of plants. You don't have to drink alcoholic beverages. Okay? But most Americans don't eat enough plants. So actually some of them do get some benefit from the alcoholic beverage. I'm not saying there's no benefit to it. But why would I want to take something that gives me all these risks as well? Not only with addiction, but with liver cancer and weight problems. I prefer, even though at one time in my life I was a moderate drinker, I decided that that was not best for my health or my moral development, and I got rid of that. If you come to another decision, you can still be my friend. But I thought I'd let you know that. Okay? Let's tell you just a few other things about the Egyptians. And that is simply this. I want to speed through this because we won't talk about their problems with gallbladder disease. We need to go to our next culture so we can finish on time. But DNA has shown all kinds of problems with the Egyptians, immune system problems that left them prone to parasites, bacteria, viruses. There's all kinds of fascinating data that we're not going to go into. If this is distressing to you to see all these slides, we could have talked about if we have more time. Those of you who are glad we're finishing at 12:40 can be relieved that I didn't tell you all about schistosomiasis. But I will tell you about this. This is fascinating. This autopsy of a young Egyptian man named Nakht reveals the presence of the trichinosis parasite. Egyptologists, it says here, now believe that this was the result of eating pork. Pork is one of the most common foods consumed in antiquity. This is from the Cambridge World History of Food, and they describe the Middle Eastern diet, of which Egypt is considered a part of that cultural heritage. It says, the earliest archaeological records of pork have been concentrated in the Middle East and Eastern Mediterranean. They date back over 3,000 years. Why was pork so valued? Because of the abundance of fat. The abundance and the quality of fat, it kept the meat from tasting dry. It gave this characteristically rich flavor. They describe it here as one of the most savory or delicious of all flesh foods. Some of you may have come to the same conclusion. But I've got to tell you that even today, to this day, pork is one of the leading causes of mental health problems in the world. Many people don't realize this. I'm not just making this up. Cysticercosis, it's caused by a worm, the pork tapeworm, Taenia solium, and this cysticercosis can affect the brain. I'm not going to go through all the details about this. If you want to read about it, this is right from the Centers for Disease Control here in the U.S. You can go to their website, put in cysticercosis, you can read all about this. But what I want to show you is cysticercosis is found worldwide, and it's a leading cause of brain problems. Can happen in the U.S., doesn't usually happen here, but in some places in the world, you find huge numbers of people with brain lesions from this. They can have seizures and headaches as a result of it. Look at these problems: confusion, lack of attention, balance problems, swelling of the brain. All of these are known. Death can occur if you have a heavy infection. And these are recent medical journals in the last decade that have talked about this huge worldwide problem that's from what? Eating pork. Just like they were doing in antiquity in Egypt and other countries in that region. And what I want you to see this is that 8 to 12% of the population in some parts of the world are actually affected with this. I'm not going to go through all the detail, like I said, but many people with this neurocysticercosis, and it could be totally prevented if they did what? Just avoided pork. Isn't that amazing? Now, some of you, I know, you're in a church where you've been studying health in the Bible. And isn't it interesting? We're going to talk before we finish today, before 1240 strikes, about a culture that valued the importance of avoiding pork. And it is a culture that had illumination from the Bible. So, let us go now with that background. We're not going to talk about bacteria and viruses. The Egyptians had problems with them. But hopefully you learned something. And that is that many of the modern maladies that we face today affected the Egyptians. And so remember I told you as we began that we were going to look at a culture that was strikingly similar to ours. Was the Egyptian culture very similar to ours? Yes, it was. But now I want to look with you at a second culture. And this is a culture that is going to illustrate what might have been here on this continent had we followed practices. Remember, first culture, things that gives us insight into our Western lifestyle today. Second culture, what might have been. And then finally, we'll look at a third culture, the one you don't want to miss. I'm glad some of you have been taking breaks periodically because you don't want to miss this last one. How we can combine the best of ancient and modern wisdom. We're going to look now at the lifestyle of Native Americans. There are literally hundreds of tribes, hundreds of federally recognized tribes today, not to mention ones that are not federally recognized. You can't generalize about Native Americans any more than you could about any other cultural group like Europeans or Africans. But there are many similarities in Native American practices. I told you I've done quite a bit of work with Native Americans over the years. But a lot of people, when I mention Native Americans, they think poor health. And that's because of reports like this. This is from a study called the Strong Heart Study. They actually looked at the population of Native Americans that had, in this case, diabetes and heart disease. And I want you to just see here, this is looking at the Pima Indians. They're Indians that live in modern-day Arizona, especially. You can see they're represented by the gray bar. And then you see other major population groups, non-Hispanic whites, African Americans, and Hispanic. And you look here at the percent of the population with diabetes. You see how huge this gray bar is. The Pimas, by the time they're in their 40s, about half of them have diabetes, half or more. It's a huge problem among many Native American groups. And so when I talk to people about Native Americans, they don't think of good health. They often think of poor health. But it's not because of the choice of First Nation peoples. You see, Native wisdom is alive and well today. And like I told you, I worked with many tribes in Oklahoma, many tribal leaders. I've been on many reservations. I've hosted the radio show for many years. And if you're interested in that show, it doesn't air right here in the Mount Shasta area, I don't think. But because it's syndicated, it's on 70 or 80 stations, and some stations will pick it up or a new station will come on, and I don't keep track of everyone who's carrying it. But you can actually listen to the show archived at lifetalk.net. That's the network that produces it. So if you go to lifetalk.net and you click on podcasts, you find American Indian Living, and you can listen to the radio show. But Actually, there's been some fascinating work done anthropologically by scientists looking at Native American wisdom. And one of the fascinating things we find, despite the stereotypes today, Native Americans historically were not obese. And in fact, unlike many cultures, Native Americans had a very corporate sense of identity. They would share. They wouldn't hoard their food. You know, in European cultures, some of the European cultures, how did you show how great you were? By how big you were. That's right. You ever seen pictures of Henry VIII? I mean, he was a great man in many respects, wasn't he? And the greater he got, the greater he got. Really, this showed that he had it made. And even the translators of the King James Version kind of had that mindset. You know, it talks about being fat. You know, you'll be fat. Well, that's prosperous. You see, that's a sign of prosperity, that you'll be fat. So some of you, if you feel like you've got some extra weight, you can say, well, that's a sign of prosperity. But in Native American culture, it was not a sign of prosperity because everyone shared. No one could hoard food. You say, today you can get overweight without hoarding food because food is just so abundant in our culture, unlike indigenous peoples throughout the world. Well, that's a whole other discussion. But some fascinating illustrations into Native American life come from the pen of Jacques Lemoyne. How many of you have heard of Jacques Lemoyne? Okay, I see a few of you. Jacques Lemoyne was one of the first Europeans to come to this continent. And he, in his party from France, actually first met Native Americans who'd never had any contact with Europeans before that. So he drew illustrations and wrote descriptions of what he saw. Fortunately for us today, another Frenchman, Theodore Debray, was inspired by Lemoyne's watercolors, and he made copperplate engravings of his pictures. And so if you were to look at one of Lemoyne's watercolors, this is a depiction of his French party arriving in Florida. And you can see there's Debray's watercolor. I mean, copperplate engraving of this watercolor. You see how similar they look, right? So you got the picture. Many of the watercolors did not survive, but the copperplate engravings have. They're much more durable. Listen to some of Lemoyne's descriptions of the Native Americans he met. This is the chief. Here's what he wrote about him, of course, translated from the French. This chief of Thor was very handsome, wise, honorable, and strong, and at least half a foot taller than the tallest of our men. He was grave and modest, and his bearing was what? Majestic. How did they describe the ladies? How did Lemoyne describe the ladies of the Sakota people that he met? They were of reasonable, good proportion. They were delighted with walking in the fields and beside the rivers. They were an active people. They were a healthy people. They were a fit people. Look at this, more modern research. Some years ago, I visited the National Institutes of Health Division in Phoenix, Arizona. I was doing work with Native Americans and actually gave a presentation there. And they had done some very interesting research. They had records for over 100 years now looking at diabetes in the Phoenix area, which is where the Gila River Indian Reservation is, in that general neck of the woods, if you will. Some 4,000 Pima people in 1902. How many cases of diabetes? Only one case. Diabetes in antiquity was unknown among Native Americans. One of the things that I've studied is Native American traditional remedies. There are no traditional remedies for diabetes in ancient Native American culture. Why is that? They didn't have it. They didn't need any natural remedies. One case of diabetes in 1902. The population had not changed significantly in 1940 when the famous Dr. Joslin was there. Dr. Joslin started a clinic, a very famous diabetes clinic in the Boston area called the Joslin Clinic, still running today, does a lot with diabetes and diabetes research. When he was there, there were 21 cases of diabetes. Is that a significant increase from one? Yes, but still a very small percentage, only about 5%, right? But look what today is like. I already showed you the statistics. From that same Pima people, over 50% of those in middle age have diabetes. What's happened? Have their genes changed in 100 years? No, it's not the genes, it's the lifestyle. And here's a fascinating natural experiment published by those researchers in Phoenix. They looked at two groups of Pima peoples. Some of those Pimas were living in Arizona. Others were living in Mexico. What had happened some 700 to 1,000 years ago, these two Pima peoples diverged. Some of them went down to Mexico, some stayed in what is today Arizona. We know they're the same population, same stock. They speak the same language family. They have the same genetic markers. Actual genetic analysis has been done of these people. But they were separated. And now they're living very different lifestyles. This was published in the journal Diabetes Care back in 1994. It's a fascinating study. It's what we call a natural experiment. Look at this. The Mexican Pimas, they're living in a remote area in northwestern Mexico. They're very active. They're on a traditional diet that's very low in fat. They're eating lots of fiber. And look at this. This is how their diet was described by these researchers in the journal Diabetes Care. What were they eating? They were basically vegetarians. By the way, some of you may not realize this, but in fact, most physicians don't even realize it, but research like this is showing that the very finest diet for people with diabetes is actually a total vegetarian diet. Many diabetics have been taught they need to eat animal protein. The animal protein contains animal fat, and this is one of the things that actually leads to insulin resistance. That is one of the root causes of diabetes. So these Native Americans on the low-meat diet, low-fat diet, compared with the Arizona Pimas, their cousins, who are much less active, higher fat, lots of animal products. Let's look at the difference. Very interesting. Now, this slide here is perfect for this stage in the program because some of you are starting to get a little weary, so you've got to do a little bit of math. I want you to notice here, they're looking, first of all, at the Mexican women, Pimas, comparing them to the Arizona Pimas. Same average age, 36. Here's their weight, 59.8. That's in kilograms. Who can quickly multiply 59.8 times 2.2? Quickly. Who's good at math? Come on. 132, someone said? Okay, somewhere in that ballpark. Even if you don't do the math very well, these folks here are 50% heavier. 50%. You see, 60 versus 90, basically. Now you say, well, that's because they're taller. Well, the height's in centimeters. Quickly divide 154 by 2.54 to get inches, and then divide that by 12. What's your answer? Okay, let's make it easy for you. These folks are only 5 centimeters taller. That's 2 inches. 2 inches does not entitle you to gain 50% more in weight. You with me? There's a much heavier people. That's the body mass index below. A body mass index of 25 means you're normal weight. 35.5 means you're obese. Look at this. Cholesterol's on average 20 points higher in these young women, but this is what's really amazing. About 4 times the risk of diabetes. Yes, the Mexican women are genetically predisposed to diabetes. 1 in 10 of them have diabetes. But look at this. Over 1 in 3, more than 1 in 3, have it in Arizona. Even more remarkable, the men. They looked at men approaching the age of 50, still in the prime of life. We all know that, up into our 80s and 90s, now that my mother-in-law is 92. Once you get to be over 100, then you're starting to get old. But look here, 48. Down here, 40-point higher cholesterol in the Arizona men on that high-fat, more sedentary program. Look at the diabetes. About 9 times as much diabetes in 2 groups of people, genetically the same. Do you see? It's not just in the genes. It's in the lifestyle. Are you starting to catch a glimpse of what might have been? And what we've found in research that I've done, we did this back in Oklahoma, and we see it at Weimar Institute, we find when people get on a more natural lifestyle, like Native Americans valued, more exercise, more plant products. By the way, sometimes I do a number of hour presentation just on Native American practices, but Native Americans, most tribes, before Europeans came here, were following largely vegetarian or plant-based diets. Sure, all of them pretty much used a little bit of wild game or fish, depending on the tribe. But if you look at the records, most of them were largely following plant-based diets. And you go to many Native American cultures, they'll tell you about the three sisters. You ever heard of the three sisters? Yeah, corn, beans, and squash. Those were the staples. Those were the revered foods. They were plant foods. Arizona, the Pimas, I don't have it in this presentation, but in some of my slides, I have an aerial photograph of large, of the remnants of large irrigation canals that were irrigating huge tracts of the Sonoran Desert. They were largely subsisting, not on wild game. There's not a lot of wild game in the desert. They were agriculturally thriving. Many anthropologists believe that the population of Arizona in 1950 was comparable to the population in 1000 AD. That's how prosperous the Hohokam people were. They were the predecessors of the Pimas and the Tehama Adams, which are tribes that still are in Arizona today. Okay, I'm not going to go through data how we've shown in some of our work, whether it's at Weimar or at the Lifestyle Center of America where I used to work, that this same diet, this same lifestyle, getting away from the animal products, losing weight, exercising more, can make dramatic differences, helps people get off of insulin if they have diabetes, helps their neuropathy go away. All kinds of remarkable things happen. And here's the exciting message that we learned from Native Americans, from this second culture. That if you learn from the wisdom of these First Nation peoples, these simple lifestyle practices can turn back the clock on heart disease or diabetes or other chronic diseases. And they had many things that they practiced. We're going to talk about many of these things tonight in the Methuselah Factor. We're going to look at longevity. And many of the practices that science has validated today are things that Native Americans valued. From eating better, to being temperate in their eating, to fasting, exercise, herbs, natural remedies, water treatments, social support, living in harmony with their Creator, and applying progressive insights. So, with that in mind, I'm going to quickly fast forward to our third culture, because we want to get you out on time today. Whether you think it's on time or not, I'm letting you out 20 minutes early. And if some of you feel cheated, we might go a little bit later tonight, but not this morning, because I know some of you had conflicting expectations. Okay? So here we go. Where did Native Americans get their wisdom? And I bet we'll actually see this slide. Here, is it up? Okay. Where did they get their wisdom, and why did wealthy Egyptians veer away from healthy lifestyle practices? Isn't that an interesting question? And this answer, I believe, comes to us from a third culture, and it's the culture of the biblical world. Culture of the biblical world. There is a book written by a Hebrew convert to Christianity. We already looked at something he had to say. You remember seeing this text earlier from the scriptures, where Paul spoke about God revealing himself in nature? So the biblical culture, you see, taught that the revelation of nature was not complete. And I want to show you an amazing case history that brings us back into contact with that first Egyptian culture. Look at this. In the midst of the opulence of Egypt, there was a group of people that had accepted God's call to follow him, and they were slaves. God dramatically led his people, the biblical account says, out of slavery to freedom, and he led them out through the Red Sea into the desert. They come to this place called the Wilderness of Shur. Here's an actual picture of where they traveled. That's the Sinai Peninsula. This is what it looks like. It's a pretty bleak place. And while they were traveling out there, the account says they went 3 days in the wilderness and they found what? How do you feel when you haven't had water for 3 hours or anything to drink? 3 days. No water. This is very bad. Now, no doubt they had water supplies with them, but after 3 days, they probably had depleted all of their supplies. And it says here that actually God led them to a place with abundant water, but it was toxic, called Mara. Can you imagine the situation? Probably the youngest kids were up at the front of the group, and they see water out there. They run up to the water. They, you know, dive in, drink some of it, and what happened? They spit it out, I'm sure. It said the waters were bitter. But the sense is that the water didn't just taste bad, it was unwholesome. Listen, if you're dying of thirst, you know what you do? You drink water no matter what it tastes like, right? You don't say, well, this water, you know, tastes like it sat in the plastic jug too long. If you haven't had water for 3 days, you're going to drink it. The water was unfit to drink. And so Moses cries out to the Lord, and the Lord shows him there's a remedy right close at hand. Isn't that interesting? I think sometimes the remedies that we need are very close at hand. We just don't realize it. And so God tells Moses what to do, to cut down this tree, throw it in the water, and it will heal the water. And then it says this in Exodus 15, if you'll diligently heed the voice of the Lord your God and do what is right in his sight and give ear to his commandments and keep all his statutes, I will put none of these diseases on you which I have brought on the Egyptians, for I am the Lord who heals you. God is saying to his people that the way of health is in cooperating with him. Isn't that interesting? Cooperating with the Creator God. So what diseases was God talking about when he said none of the diseases of the Egyptian? You have some insight into that after our presentation today? Yeah, we talked about all these diseases that they had. God was promising his people longevity and prosperity, but he was saying, just cooperate with me. Now, to how many of you does that sound like a terrible thing to do? It's amazing to me as a physician. People often think that when a doctor tells them to do something, it's messing up their life. You're like, why are you a doctor? That nerve. I've had patients get mad at me, you know, because I told them to eat better or change their diet or something, and they just wanted a prescription. Now, nowadays, that doesn't happen too much because I work in places where people come because they want to change their lifestyle. So they're happy. But in traditional medical practice, a lot of people say, I don't want that. Give me a pill. But isn't it amazing? God says he wants us to cooperate with him. And so God gave a promise in the context of healed waters. And he connects healing with his counsel. Isn't that amazing? Obedience and health are linked together in this biblical culture, in this biblical worldview. So, in return for obedience, what was God promising? None of the diseases of Egypt. Now, let me show you this. Very interesting. Biblical culture was always designed to bless, not to restrict. You see, most people in religious circles today, regardless of what faith tradition they're a member of, they think of religion as restricting them. But in the Bible, God is always seeking to bless. And you could study this, but I find most Christians haven't even read much of the Bible. You go to Deuteronomy 5 and 6, which is right after the Ten Commandments are given the second time. Do you know why this book is called Deuteronomy? Yeah, deutero means second. Nomos is the law. It's the second giving of the law. That's what Deuteronomy literally means. And you go to Deuteronomy 5 and 6, and it doesn't say God's giving you all these rules to show he's boss and to keep you in line. That's not what it says. Look at some examples with me. Deuteronomy 5 and 6. God gives the Ten Commandments, and then here's what he says. You must therefore be careful to do as the Lord your God has commanded you, because God will strike you dead otherwise. Is that what it says? No, this is not the view of God that the Bible teaches. Christians throughout history have missed this. God gives these commands. Why? He says you must follow exactly the path that the Lord has commanded. For what reason? So that you may live, and that it may go well with you, and that you may live long in the land that you are to possess. Now, why should that get people angry? You know, why should they think religion is a restrictive thing? This is what the God of the Bible is revealing. And he's showing us. I can tell you, from a medical perspective, I can tell you, from the perspective of someone who was once an agnostic, who thought the Bible was just a bunch of fairy tales, I can tell you from having looked at this book honestly, it is a book that bears scientific scrutiny today. It stands up. It's accurate when it comes to the health, not only the health council, but I would go so far as to say as the cosmology, the explanation of why we're here. Here's another statement from Deuteronomy. Hear therefore, O Israel, and observe them diligently, so what? It may go well with you. and so that you may multiply greatly in a land flowing with milk and honey. Someone says, well, see there, we can eat all the honey we want and drink all the milk we want. Actually, Hebrew scholars tell us this phrase, milk and honey, flowing with milk and honey, is an expression of the agricultural productivity of the land. You see, if something's flowing with milk, it means your cows, your cattle, your sheep, they're prolific. They're flowing with milk. They have lots of offspring. And if there's lots of honey, what does that mean? That's right, lots of bees, lots of agricultural productivity. So it never said your diet is going to be milk and honey. It was an expression of the agricultural productivity of the land flowing with milk and honey as the Lord your God has promised you. So it's really a health program that God gave his people in the biblical cultural worldview. It was a program that was designed to lead them back to his original plan. Some of you I've heard have been studying this plan in, what is the name of the town where this Bible study is going on? Dunsmuir. You see, I'm not a local around here. I don't even know where Dunsmuir is. But I heard there's a group studying Tuesday nights, is it? They're studying this very perspective, how God is trying to lead people back to his original perspective. Anyone in this room in that study? Okay, I see several hands. And I understand it's totally filled. No one else could join, is that right? No, there's actually some room left, is that true? Could you squeeze someone in? Okay, so if you want to learn more about this biblical worldview, that's something you can take advantage of. That's what they're studying. They're studying these practical counsel that spoke to me as an agnostic. That's one of the things I was studying as a young adult that inspired me to say there's something about this biblical worldview that is different from all the other cultures. God said he was calling them back to his original plan. And I want to just observe something as we're finishing up here today. I've looked at many different cosmologies, many different cultures, and a lot of people today in America say, you know what, these first few chapters of the book of Genesis, I mean, they're just, you know, it's just stupid. You know, everyone knows it started with a big bang and we just evolved. But, you know, I got to just tell you something. The more I look at cultural wisdom of ancient peoples, I say, you know what, we got to be careful just before we throw everything under the rug. But I look at all the ancient beliefs about how we got here. You know, there's a Chinese tradition that the world hatched from a cosmic egg. And there was this Pan Ku that grew and you know, the cosmic egg split and you know, his arms ended up becoming the mountains and different things. And, you know, Chinese people that say that, they say, nah, that didn't really happen that way. I mean, we know better than that now. And you read traditions from the Norse literature, from the Scandinavian countries, and they talk about battles of the gods, and this is how, you know, creation happened. And you talk with people from Scandinavia and say, no, we don't. That's not really the way it was. It doesn't make sense. There's no evidence for that. You talk with people from Native American cultures, and many of them say the same. Yeah, we had all these stories about the bear and the turtle, and you know, they're just legends. We know that the earth didn't actually come to be that way. But when you study the first two chapters of Genesis as a physician, this commands our attention because everything in that Genesis story is just what is calculated to give us optimal health today. Do you know that there's a description in the very first chapter of Genesis of what the ideal diet was, the original diet? Do you know that? Do you know what it says? It says it was a plant-based diet, a total vegetarian diet. Now, let me just observe something for you. This is not what the Israelites were seeing in Egypt. There was no cultural value in that Middle Eastern society to elevate a vegetarian diet. Do you see the point? If you were writing, if it was just Moses was writing something that he made up, he's not going to tell people the ideal diet was vegetarian. He's going to say the ideal diet, you know, is pork and geese and beer. I mean, these were what they grew up with. These were the fine foods. Remember, even in Egypt, they were crying out for what? The flesh pots of Egypt. They were not vegetarians. He wasn't writing something to vindicate the vegetarian diet. What's even more amazing, you read the first two chapters of Genesis, and you know what he has people doing in a perfect world? He has them working. They were working in their gardens. Now, I've actually heard that there is going to be a class here very soon on gardening. Is this true? When is that coming up? April 25. There's going to be a gardening class that some of the folks who are responsible for this meeting are working with. And, you know, let me just tell you how revolutionary this is. Do you realize that in just about every culture in antiquity, work was considered demeaning? The people that did the work were the losers. You know, the big guys, they got to sit there and have the musicians play for them, and people give them food and drink. Who was the people that worked? They were the poor people. They were the servants. Do you see how countercultural Genesis 1 and 2 is? It has people eating a vegetarian diet. It has them exercising, doing useful work. Listen, even if you don't believe anything about the Bible, it would cause me, and it does, as a physician, to say, why is this so different? It's not talking about like the Babylonians believed there was a giant sea monster that had to be slain, and that's how the earth was created. There's no cosmic egg. There's no battle of the gods. There is something about this creation account in Genesis that says, listen, there is something here that is not just the product of human wisdom. And so as we close today, I want to suggest to you that as we've looked at these three different cultures, there are lessons for us. First of all, we looked at Egyptian culture, right? And we see that the Egyptians, although they had great wisdom about certain areas of science and preserving bodies, they didn't have practical wisdom as far as lifestyle. They were dying of the same diseases that we die of today. We then looked at Native Americans who live very close to the land, who seem to have cultural wisdom that preserved them from some of the same things that the Egyptians looked like they had such an advanced society. Some people would label Native American societies as not very advanced. They didn't have this high technology the way some people would label it. I didn't tell you. Many Native American tribes were doing successful brain surgery. We know this. Throughout the Americas, there are signs of healed brain surgeries. That means brain surgeries where people survived. And the brain, the cranium, the brain casing, the bone, actually healed. So we know they had surgery and survived. So they were not a backward people, but they lived very simply, were in touch with nature. And then we looked at this third culture, the biblical worldview. And I would like to suggest to you that that biblical worldview blends these cultures because it really says God is revealed in nature. The Native Americans, yes, they may not have known the God of the Bible. They may not have had the scriptures, but they were seeing God in creation. And as they applied the truths of wisdom that are in nature, they benefited. But, the greatest motivation for healthful living comes when we understand the real purpose for our being here. And I have found personally that there is no better explanation for why we're here than the perspective given in the scriptures. If you haven't had that privilege of studying, you look up the Guthries or Randy over here. I know he's one of the people involving Randy. Raise your hand. But there's a number of people here I've met that are leading out in some kind of interfaith Bible studies. If you're interested in looking more at this Hebrew and biblical worldview, it's fascinating. It changed my life to look at it. It has cutting-edge medical wisdom today. And in fact, so powerful is it that I would like to just have a word of prayer to that Creator God before we finish right now. Father in heaven, we thank you that you reveal to us your loving character, that you're a God that wants us to prosper and be in health. And you know, in my own experience, I at one time thought the Bible was just a bunch of fairy tales and wasn't really impressed with people that called themselves Christians. But as we've looked today, there's something special about the Bible. For those that have seen that, continue to help them studying and learning the practical things that show about a loving God that treats everyone lovingly. Help us have that same spirit to be kind to everyone, to be considerate, to accept all cultures, to love people as they are. But help us to have that same spirit like you had, that even though we love everyone where they're at, you were so willing to teach us the best way to live that you made things clear. Help us have that experience in our own lives as we learn from one another and as we learn from your word. We ask in the name of our loving Creator. Amen.